Welcome to The Big Rich Show. This podcast will focus on conversations with friends and acquaintances within the four-wheel drive industry. Many of the people that I will be interviewing, you may know the name, you may know some of the history, but let's get in depth with these people and find out what truly makes them a four-wheel drive enthusiast. So now's the time to sit back, grab a cold one, and enjoy our conversation.
Whether you're crawling the Red Rocks of Moab or hauling your toys to the trail, Maxxis has the tires you can trust for performance and durability. Four wheels or two, Maxxis tires are the choice of champions because they know that whether for work or play, for fun or competition, Maxxis tires deliver. Choose Maxxis. Tread victoriously.
Why should you read Four Low Magazine? Because Four Low Magazine is about your lifestyle, the four-wheel drive adventure lifestyle that we all enjoy. Rock crawling, trail riding, event coverage, vehicle builds, and do-it-yourself tech all in a beautifully presented package. You won't find Four Low on the newsstand rack, so subscribe today and have it delivered to you. On today's episode of Conversations with Big Rich, we have Ben Bauer. Ben has been around the off-road industry a long time. He was a motorcycle racer. He owns a gorgeous flat fender, which we'll talk about. He's very meticulous in his preparation of parts. I always kid him about, you know, the car's polished way better than any four-wheel drive needs to be. But we'll get into that, and we'll also get into his relationship with Jason Shear and IFS and the problems that they solved and have overcome with that. So Ben, thank you for being on board with Conversations and talking with us and myself and with our listeners. I just wanted to say I miss you, dude. It's been a while since I've seen you.
It has been a while, and I'm honored to have you call and set this up.
Yeah, well, we want to find out your history. You know, I'll let everybody know that Ben is Charlene Bauer's dad. We'll get into that a little later. But before Charlene came Ben and his wife, Deanna. So we'll talk about them. But first, let's
talk. My number one pit crew is Deanna. Absolutely.
Yep, absolutely. So let's talk about your beginnings. Where did you grow up and go to school and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I think a lot of this podcast is kind of go toward techie stuff. And thinking about that, I was born and raised in basically Berkeley, a little small community called Kensington. And my dad was a maintenance manager for the 76 Union Oil Refinery out in Rodeo. You should know that because you're a local guy.
Absolutely.
And I can't believe it, but he bought me a Shopsmith when I was 10 years old.
Okay, we may have to tell everybody what a Shopsmith is. I happen to know because I had one.
A Shopsmith is one of those multiple tools that you have to make to work with wood, basically. Yes. Although today I'm using it to cut aluminum.
Oh, really?
And it's a table saw and lathe and drill press and all that kind of stuff. And every time you want to change to something else, it takes you 15 minutes to a half an hour. So you have a lot of time thinking about things. How about that?
Yeah, I'd forgotten all about the Shopsmiths. There was one in our garages growing up, and it was the first thing I got to work on with wood, without my dad actually knowing I was doing it. Until he found holes in everything and some of the stuff that he had precise cut wood for certain things. And then he'd come in and they'd be shorter. So I learned.
Well, it was a great learning experience, and I can't believe that I still have 10 digits after all that.
That means you're good and careful.
Sure. And my dad being a maintenance guy, you know, I said, you know, I kind of want my own bedroom. And we had lived on the hills there in Kensington. And so he says, well, go build yourself a room.
Wow.
So I started digging, and, you know, we went on from there. But that kind of was the beginning of putting things together. And really, when I went through school and all that, I was not really a techie. I was more of a jock, and played basketball and on a, you know, most of the varsity teams and things like that. And then I got recruited into San Jose State to play basketball there.
Oh, awesome.
As I always claimed myself to be the sixth man. I was never the A player. I was always the sixth man, and always ready to come in and cheer, and not cheer, but play like I had to play, like they wanted me to. So I was never the A player. So I went into San Jose State and majored in engineering. I started out as mechanical and wound up as an industrial engineer because some of those things like strength of materials and other courses, just I couldn't get my head around it. Differential equations and logs. Do you remember logs and all that stuff?
Oh, man. Yes. Now all that stuff's easy.
Oh, just your mind was blown. And, you know, here I was kind of being a jock more than a student. And so something got me going into surfing. And so I quit the basketball deal. I really wasn't happy with team sports at that time.
Okay.
And I got into surfing, and then after I really had no money to do make boards or to buy a board, so I decided to make a board. And so we bought the styrofoam and stuff and started making surfboards, and eventually I'd make 5 surfboards in a weekend, and that would put me through a whole month of school for the amount of money that I made. And as I remember, we sold those boards for like $40. So.
Wow.
I might have been paid $15 a piece, but you know, you could live a week or almost a month on $100-$150, you know, at college.
Yep.
And so that started working my hands, and then also starting to understand curves because of the board structures, and you know, one side's the same as the other side and things like that. We never had templates, of course, that was a world before CAD.
Right.
And I can remember I was a Philly, here again, a B surfer. And the guys always commented, well, we don't worry about you until it gets above 10 feet because you're not out here. But when it hits 10 feet, you're out here. And I got into one competition, and I built a surfboard that was 7 feet long. And just happened to be that it was a 10-foot day. And all the pros came up from Southern California, and more than half of them came over and says, what's with this board you got here? And the only reason I made it 7 feet is because I screwed up a 10-foot board, and that's all I had. That's all the foam I had left. But it's kind of, you know, a little pat in the back, something different. And, of course, I didn't win anything, but, you know, they could see that things happened quicker than the old longboards,
right.
Like was usual back then. And this would have been early 60s.
Okay.
And so basically surfed my way out of school, and the Marine Corps came along. And one thing about I keep coming back to sports again because I want to say that the thing that really got me through motorcycles where I originally wound up was conditioning.
Right.
And so one thing you do when you're not surfing is you're playing volleyball on the beach. And you know, I got my draft notice and all this kind of stuff. And he said, I went into a Marine Corps recruit station, and the guy says, well, I can't talk to you now. We got one spot open, but I got to go play volleyball for lunch. I go, well, I play volleyball. And he says, you got your shorts? And I go, absolutely. So I played volleyball, and he says, I'm going to make a couple telephone calls, take this test here, and an hour later, I was recruited in. He says, you're going to go in at this time, and then you're going to go on to the Marine Corps-based volleyball team, and then you can go on from there if you can do good. Well, I went all the way up to the All-Marine team and then the Inter-Service team.
That's awesome. And,
yeah, that would have probably been around 66, somewhere in that range. And that actually got me going to where later on I was started playing for the Olympic Club, which you'll know the Olympic Club from yes. San Francisco.
Absolutely.
And so I played for them for a number of years. And actually got chosen onto the Olympic team as a trials person. Now, there were 20 people chosen. 19 were from Southern California, and I was the only one from Northern California. So you know where that went.
Right.
And I put up with that for about a month, and I go, no, this is not for me. And here again, I'm the B player, so it just wasn't worth taking a whole year out to get prepared for that. And so anyhow, in around 66, after I got out of the Marine Corps, I started surveying. Or, you know, one of the guys on the survey crew.
Right.
And what we did all the survey work for BART and all that stuff. So I was the seventh person to walk through the BART tube underneath the bay. How about that?
Well,
both ways.
That's pretty cool. You walk
yeah.
both ways? How long is that tube?
It's 7 miles.
Did you walk it in one day, both ways?
Well, yeah, because your car's the other way. I probably walked it 20 or 30 times. Because we were doing all the surveying, you know, through the check surveying.
Right.
I mean, there's stories about that bar tube. Oh.
Can you tell them?
Oh, yeah.
Give us
you
one
want me to tell
one.
Them? Okay. I'm going to give you one because the tubes were, so it's a 7 mile tube, but they were made in 300 foot sections.
Okay.
And those sections were made in the Bethlehem shipyards there in South San Francisco.
Yep.
And we'd have to go out there at 5:30 in the morning and measure those tubes for the length because they would be at the same temperature of the water that was right there. Because during the daytime, they would get longer by 6 inches or so.
Really? That much?
Yeah, it's crazy. So the next thing they did is they launched these tubes just like a ship, float them out into the bay, and then they put big fences up on top of the tube, and they'd start loading gravel and things like that on top of the tube and sink them. Well, at the end of each tube was, what do you call it, a hatch that you walk through?
Okay.
Being a boat guy.
Right.
And these hatches, they had hatches on both ends. So they'd sink the tube down. They had big train couplers on it. And they would adjust the tube, get it all close together, put hydraulics to the train catches, you know, the whatever.
Right.
Pull the two tubes together, pump out about 300 gallons of water between the two hatches. We'd open the one hatch that's in the tube and then the other hatch, which is in the 300 section. And I'd walk through down to the other end and set up basically a target. And they had already set up their their scopes and all that stuff.
Right.
So they would sight through and they said, oh, the tube's got to go down an inch or it's got to go left an inch or, you know, or 3 inches or something like that. Well, I'm standing in the end of this tube and it's 70 feet underneath the water. And all of a sudden you can feel this tube go up in the air and then they drop it.
And you're standing in the tube.
And I'm standing inside this tube. And this, I mean, you're 3-4 miles from land on, you know, whatever side you're working on. So there's no getting out. There's no getting out.
Wow.
So that was, you know, the best thing about that whole thing was it was an incredible feat of engineering. And I says, oh, this is just amazing. And if a guy can do, figure all this stuff out, you can figure out anything. And this, you know, if you remember, that's about when they started doing the space stuff, you know. So
right.
It was a great year for, great time for tech. Just a great time for tech. And just your mind was just going all the time.
That's awesome. That I've learned so much just in the short period of time conversation with you about you that I didn't know. And this is why I do these. This is awesome.
Well, when it all comes down to the end, you relate. And it's all this background. It's all these people. I call them mentors. Right. I mean, every time you go along, I mean, you had mentors in sports. You had mentors in your survey crew. You know, when you're screwing up, you're screwing up. When you don't know how to do it right, they're going to tell you and why.
Yes.
And so you have these mentors. You know, as you go along, and I kept saying, use your ears, open your ears, let these people talk. It made a heck of an impression on me over the years. So getting back about that, the survey thing, we were surveying through San Francisco because they built these big ditches up Market Street, and they didn't want the 40 and 50 story buildings to collapse into that trench. So we were constantly going along and making sure they weren't tipping inside Market Street.
That's good.
Yeah. It's a good plan, right?
Yeah.
And, we had a deal every day. San Francisco is so cool because there's so many awesome restaurants. I mean, every quarter of a block, there's a nice restaurant.
Right, and any kind of food you can imagine is being prepared in San Francisco.
Absolutely, 100%.
You can say a lot
of
wacky things.
So our deal was, as at 12 noon, wherever we were standing, we would walk into the closest restaurant for lunch.
Wow.
And for some reason, we weren't on Market Street. We were someplace else. But at noon, we were right next to a Honda shop. And we weren't really hungry, so we walked in and walked out a half an hour later buying three 350 Scramblers. Now, I knew zero about a motorcycle. I had no clue. I guess I was repairing my own cars by this time, because I was probably in the 20-ish, 21, somewhere in that. 22. And the only reason I was working on my own cars because I didn't have the money to have anybody else work on them.
Right.
You know, so that's kind of the way it was back then.
Absolutely.
So I got the bike somehow. I think at the time I was living down in San Jose again because of school and buddies and things like that. And so Saturday, I brought the bike on a Wednesday, and I kind of went around the streets a little bit Thursday and Friday. And my neighbor across the street was kind of a trials rider. So he says, hey, come up to the Santa Cruz Mountains with us, let's go riding, because that Scrambler was kind of half and half. And so we went up into the Santa Cruz Mountains, and I had the greatest time. Because now you're in the boonies, you're in through the ferns, you're in through trails that I really wasn't familiar with the redwoods. By this time, I had hiked a lot of the back country of Yosemite and Kings Canyon, all that through a Boy Scouts
right. deal.
So I went almost to Eagle Scout on that. But you know, you just start adding things up here, and I go, wow, that's pretty cool. Well, Monday I went down and bought knobby tires, took off all the chrome stuff, turn signals, headlights, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Fenders.
And I've always had a van, so that, you know, I could shag it around in a van. And there's another word you can't use anymore. Shag.
Shag.
So we started going up to the Santa Cruz Mountains, and of course it's always wet, so you're slip sliding and having fun. And that was probably around 68, somewhere in that range. So I had a couple more years to. Then I went back to college and finished up in 1970, and I went to work for Owens, Illinois Glass Company in Oakland, where it was a glass plant, as an industrial engineer. And I was so broke that I showed up on day one and I had to ask my boss for money so that I could buy gas.
To get home and back again the next morning, huh?
And to get to work. Exactly. And I think by the third month, I had to sell my bike also to be able to, you know, just to have cash. I think on the third month, I went into the credit union and I got enough money to buy a Husqvarna. So that was right in 1970. And as an industrial engineer, well, I was kind of laying out new corrugated, not offices, but the, you know, where they build corrugated boxes and things like that.
Right.
I got here again. I had a mentor. Is this, come on, Ben, we can relay out this whole production area and get it going so we make money. Okay. So here's a mentor that's pushing you. And I also was doing the budgets. So now all of a sudden you're becoming a math person and a person who can deal with numbers, things like that. And of course you have to have a balance sheet and it has to balance. So it had to be accurate. So that was a good thing. At the same time, I befriended the guy at the Husqvarna shop, and he happened to be John Nelson, who had actually ridden the 6 days trials, which is a 6 day race. And I think he rode in like Spain, something like that.
Wow.
And, but by that time I hadn't done any enduros. I hadn't done anything like that, basically because I was just coming out of the mountains. Well, he was an enduro rider. He says, come on, let's go ride enduros. Well, he saw that, you know, I was riding good and all of, and with enduros, it's kind of like it's all navigational. Well, not totally navigational. You have to keep certain speeds and things like that. And if you come in early, it's 2 points against you. And if you're late 1 minute, it's 1 point against you.
Right. So it's
the guy with the less than amounts wins, right?
Right. Time distance type.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Well, that's the enduro thing. And that fit me perfect because all of a sudden I'm into numbers. You know, being an engineer, it was just right up my alley, and the speeds were not super fast speeds because they had to have people finish, and it was more like, well, you know what the Sierras are like. They can be muddy, they can be fast, they can be dusty, they can be snowy. Everything,
but it's your average speed between checkpoints.
Yeah,
you have to nail it, right?
Right. And I remember, I mean, I wound up winning a lot of these enduros is overall, but the one I remember the most is the cowbell.
Oh,
which was right around 1971. There was 1,400 guys that started, and when it started, it had already been raining for 2 days. The Eel River was so deep that we were handing our motorcycles across the Eel River, you know, buddied up.
Wow.
And then to try to get out the other side, there was 100, 200, 300 guys stuck on the other side trying to get up this hill. Well, I basically used motorcycles as traction to get up. And I think out of 1,400 guys, I think there was only 10 of us that finished.
Wow.
So, but here again, it goes back to this conditioning thing.
Yes.
You know, where your health is not the issue. It's just perseverance.
Right.
So along with, then John Nelson kind of got me into this ISDT. He says, you know, you have the Moxie to do this 6-day race and things like that. And through that, I met Malcolm Smith.
Very good.
And of course, you know what kind of a mentor he is.
Absolutely.
And, you know, as I started, you know, working my way up, we also noticed problems with production bikes. And, you know, we'd look at things and they'd say, well, gee, there's a bushing there that's made out of rubber. Well, why can't we make a bushing out of polyurethane that's not going to ever go away? You know, so there's a lot of that stuff that I wound up making small parts for Malcolm, and he wound up selling them for me, and that was a great boost for me and kept me interested in working.
Right.
And, you know, we developed, here again, you do, you have to do tire changes in 3 minutes. Whether you're on the trail, you get a flat tire on the trail, you stop, you take the tire out of the motorcycle, undo it from one side, take out the tube, put in another tube, put it back on the rim, use the CO2 cartridges that we developed it all about that same time so that we didn't have to sit there with air pumps.
Nice.
And, but we also developed the easy way to get, I mean, we would stop and I could have the tire laying on the ground within 10 seconds. And I found out also that I could take the rim and the side that I wanted the tire to come off of, I would take that rim and narrow it down, or, you know, take a couple hundred thousandths off of it. So you could almost, if you went, put the tire into the drop center on the one side, you could almost push the tire off the rim by with your hands without using a tire tool. Now, what that meant is, if you got a flat tire, you're stopping right now.
you're not riding on a flat.
Yeah. But if you're riding fast enough to stay ahead of in the 6 days, you just have to make checkpoints at a certain time. You have to be, it's okay to be early. You can just never be late.
Okay.
If you're ever late, you're off the gold standard. Ever in 6 days. And there was about 13 of these checkpoints a day.
Okay.
And you did about 200 miles a day.
Wow.
The idea was to ride hard enough, but not crazy enough, because you had 6 days of riding. And here again, I wasn't the fastest rider, but let's call it consistent. You knew that you had to finish.
Yes.
You got to finish to win, right? How many times have we heard that? I guess that's when the motorcycle thing started, and my zest for racing and making the bike the best it can possibly be.
So how
and
many
taking everything, I mean, you knew every nut and bolt, you knew what wrench to pull out. You practiced at changing things all the time because, okay, I had a hard time changing. How could I make it easier to fix or make it so it doesn't break? You know, you have a choice.
Right.
You can make it so it doesn't break, but all of a sudden, you know, wow, I just added 10 pounds to my bike. That's no good.
So how many parts do you think that you developed in those days trying to make the bikes easier to work on or to last longer? Like you're talking about, well, that it's not a part, but, you know, shaving the one side of the rim down so that the tire was easier to put on. You could take the tire off in 10 seconds. Did you have quick connects? What was it that you did to expedite that process?
Well, in that case, the first thing was we always used to have to break the chain.
Okay.
So the first thing was trying to figure out how to derail the chain. In other words, push the axle forward so you could derail the chain. That was number one. And then once you're off the chain, then you could pull the axle still in the wheel all the way back out of the bike.
Right.
And you can't do that on a production bike because of safety reasons, but you can do anything you want
on a race
when you're racing.
Yes. Got it.
And so there's a lot of stuff. And if you say, you ask about me doing something, you can't do that because we were all in this together. You know, you were talking with other people. You were discussing, hey, there's this problem. Let's, you know, how do we go through this? You know, how do we work with this? And you get five ideas. And then all of a sudden, oh, well, if we take this partial of this idea, partial of that idea, and this one, hey, we got it. So it's really hard to say that, you know, one person really develops anything. And that's what I've really found out through the whole, you know, whatever we've done, you know, forever. It's, yeah, do I have two or three patents? Yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of people that go into giving you the information that was needed, you know, to get something done.
So it was a collective.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, think about Pirate.
Yes.
Think about how Pirate moved the off-road industry, you know, from Wheeling. It was amazing, but it was collective, you know. It was one person influenced in that. Well, one person might have been influential in keeping the thread up.
True.
You know, and until, you know, people figure stuff out, it was great. So anyhow, I don't.
So how did you do in the 6 day?
I got two gold medals. So I rode three times.
Wow.
I got a gold medal with Husky in, I guess that was 73. The race was in Massachusetts, and that was good. And I had a flat tire at the last check on the last day. And that was funny because it was a real tight check, and I came into the checkpoint. And I got the tire off, and I got everything done, but I didn't have enough time to put air in it, so I pushed the bike through on my minute and then filled it up on the other side. So that was pretty close. I have to go back to talking about that, because this is where you start respecting your other racers and your riders. We were pretty much, you start out on what they call a B schedule, which is kind of breaking everybody in, and a lot of the fast guys have already broken their bikes by now, and they're out of the race. And on the third day, they're going to an A schedule, and it's going to rain. So we're in this meeting with the Husky guys, and this is where I started understanding about pits and the importance of a pit crew and what a true manufacturer's team does. But we would be riding day two. They would have three riders, and these were the big riders from Husqvarna team, you know, from Sweden, you know, the guys, the McColas and those guys.
Right.
They would bring them over, and those guys would run day three. And then they'd report back Tuesday night to us, and they'd say, okay, to check one, I had 2 minutes. Check three, I had 10 minutes. Well, if you knew there was 10 minutes, that's where you wanted to change your tire to get a fresh tire.
Okay.
And down the line. And I was having a hard time making some of the checks. I go, Malcolm, how in the hell are you going so fast? And Malcolm says, well, where do you crash? And he says, well, you always crash in the corners. And he goes, yes. So you go in deeper and come out harder. You don't go around the corners any faster. And that's all he had to say. That's all he had to say. And that's when I really found out about front brakes. Because that's where all your stopping is. And you just go in deeper. You skid those tires and try to keep your bike straight. You come out a little bit harder, you know, you don't broad slide around corners.
Right.
That's for show. Or guys go fast. If you know what's around the corner, you can broad slide it. If you don't know what's around the corner, you go in hard brake hard and come out, you know, make your turn and then come out hard after you can see what's around the corner.
Makes sense.
One of those, yeah. But it's one of those things, it makes sense, but no one talks about it.
Right.
I mean, there's so much pre-running now that guys, you don't know what guys are doing. You know, so anyhow, keep on going on. So there was no pre-running at the 6 days. So you had to kind of ride that way.
No pre-running, but you had somebody else that could pre-run it. So
yes.
At least give you notes, course notes. Okay.
Yes. They would give you an idea that, you know, hey, you go out 3 miles and there's a big damn river that you're going to be crossing. Just walk it. Or there's no rocks in it, just blast it.
Okay.
Yeah, you had a little bit of that going on. And so that was nice to be on a big team. I think that Husky team, that was, you know, that was a pretty big year. There's probably 10 of us.
Wow.
10 riders. So I learned a lot from that. And then, you know, I kept riding, going faster and whatever, and then got chosen to go to Italy, which was the second year. And I was one of these guys that, you know, hey, I like doing all my own work on the bike because I check it all out. And I got my engine guy, you know, and we know each other. And I'm looking over his shoulder, you know, here. I'm not telling him what to do. I'm just learning and see what's going on. And nope, this is a factory bike and it's special and we don't want anybody to look inside of it. Well, I get over to Italy and I can say that we got there a week early. So we're riding around, but I never got on the bike really hard. Well, 50 miles from the starting line, my crank seized. So I was out of the race 50 miles into the first day.
Wow.
But now it became really fun because that night I put in another motor. So now I'm what they call a ghost rider on the trail. So I'm basically, you're not supposed to say this, but you're basically a parts bike.
Right. Okay.
And, you know, yes, there's no outside assistance. And a lot of people don't understand this, but it can happen. I mean, I can't give you a part, but you can certainly find a part. You know, all of a sudden there just happens to be a shifter lever laying on the ground.
Exactly. I got it.
So, you know, there's all kinds of ways that, I mean, that, it's not cheating. It's just kind of the way you do it. But that was kind of neat. I know one of the guys lost the head bearings out of the, you know, the steering head.
Right.
Front fork. And another guy and myself, we worked 6 hours. And we took the, that requires taking the handlebars off, pulling the forks out of the steering head, putting new bearings in, putting it all back together, putting the bars back on again. Well, he was either not going to finish or whatever. So he said, okay, well, we found an old barn along the trail someplace. And I said, all we want you to do is just hold the bike. We're going to high center the bike. And we have it all worked out. And we replaced those head bearings in 3 minutes.
Wow.
Because we worked about 5 hours and we did it on another bike. We must have done it 15 times. So we knew exactly what we had to do.
That's
so anyhow, cool. At least he finished. It was some of those fun things that you do and report back. You know, if the guy's having a hard time, you could ride ahead to another pit and say, hey, you know, be prepared. He's going to need a tire or things like that.
Right.
You know, all this stuff that people do on radios today. Back then, there's no radios. There's no communication. There was no cell phones. No nothing. So
You had to follow, you know, the trail, the marks on the trail. There was no GPS. Did you guys, did you have like roll cards, or the roll charts?
Or did no, you we had no roll charts. What we were doing, just following arrows through the forest.
Okay.
And of course, all you needed was one person to go out there and take a couple arrows down. Then you had chaos.
Yes.
I mean, you have people going backwards on the trail now, right?
Right.
And that was, I mean, it's almost, you take arrows down, you're almost committing murder.
Oh, I agree.
In my mind.
I agree.
So that was that. Then Husky started, well, that was the beginning of, then we started having the gas wars. And the downturn of the economy.
Yep.
So Husky had to pull back, and they had their four or five guys. And I got on to another fella who was doing enduros, and he says, he worked for Bull Taco. So we built a Bull Taco. We built up Bull Tacos and took a motocross bike, made an enduro bike out of it, put in different bearings, and I started doing a lot of, you know, things that I'd done to the Huskies. I can tell you that about that time, I also bought a welder. And all of a sudden now, I'm a welder. And it wasn't just steel. Oh, by this time, also, I was pretty good gas welder because I was building expansion chambers and repairing expansion chambers.
Okay.
And what's interesting about that is you just can't repair an expansion chamber because it's all full of creosote stuff on the inside, which is, carbon. So once you heat up the expansion chamber, the carbon goes into the steel, and then all of a sudden you got real brittle steel. So you have to learn to weld with the minimum amount of heat possible.
Okay.
To get things so that carbon wouldn't go in. Little small stuff like that you find out as you go along in life, you know, these little experiences. Well, the welder deal was, so now I got a TIG welder, so now I can do aluminum. Well, to make the front wheels come off fast, I had to weld a bung onto my front fork. Which I did. The very next race, I'm out in the desert, I think probably doing about 70 miles an hour is about as fast as the bikes went back then.
I can hear where this is going.
Yeah. And and I come to this big, long, sweeping corner just outside of California City, and I just, you know how you take your front brakes to get the rear end to kind of twick out?
Yeah.
And I hit that front brake, and that bung fell off, or broke off. And it wrapped up the front brake cable. And I went over the handlebars. And it was amazing how quickly. I didn't even know I was over the bars until all of a sudden I hit the ground.
At that speed, it happens quickly.
Yes. And I just have to say, I just got a phone call from one of our good buddies, Danny Grimes.
Really? Okay. I talked to him last week.
That's how the community goes, right?
Yep.
So anyhow, I went over the bars, and so I learned that I wasn't a welder. I also, when I landed, the rear tire was between my legs, and it was still doing 70 miles an hour because it also pulled the throttle off. And so I just burnt the hell out of the inside of my legs. But anyhow, I still feel that. Oof. So let's go on to... I did the Bull Taco thing. We had a great race. We took three guys. We all got gold medals. That also meant we had to put together our own pit crew. And so I asked a bunch of friends here, you know, husbands and wives, to come over and be pit crews. They were not Bull Taco people, but they were motorcycle people, and they knew how to talk motorcycles and work on them. And they had a great time. We had a good time. one of our guys was a little temperamental. We had to tell him to cool it. You know, hey, these are volunteers out here. Don't go shouting stuff. Just talk to them. Tell them what you need. And so that was a good experience for me, trying to understand the mechanics, you know,
of a pit crew,
putting stuff like that together.
Right.
And I think it was about that time, too, I was getting a little long in the tooth with the bikes. And I had met Deanna, my wife. I met her in a bar. And our first date was that Saturday. I said, well, would you like to go out Saturday? She said, sure. Thinking, you know, I'd go out Saturday night. I said, you know, I'm going motorcycle riding in the morning up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Would you like to go? She said, sure. So I took her up there. You know, we did our ride. And then I says, well, would you like to buddy up and just ride a little bit? She goes, sure. Well, so we went did about 2 miles and up to the top of this hill. And I says, well, it's 2 miles back that way. It's about 100 yards down, straight down to the van. And she says, oh, well, 100 yards sounds okay. Well, two people on a bike is a lot different than one person. And I started down this hill, weaving my way through redwood trees.
Which don't move.
Scared like you can't believe. And I get down to the bottom, and I'm just kind of going like, oh, my God. And she's going, wee, wee, wee. That was fun.
You had a keeper then.
Yeah, there was a keeper. And then she became, I mean, pit crew in, you know, in the Bultaco thing. She was 8 months pregnant with Charlene that we talked about. And she's out there pouring gas and staying in hot tubs at nighttime. And, you know, being a true rallier.
That's awesome.
And it was also about that time I started thinking, oh, boy, now we got a family and this motorcycle thing is getting pretty crazy. Because 6 days you kind of, you know, you're riding on streets also and you're going through red lights and stop signs and you're running up cobblestone streets and guys are hitting people walking out of their homes, their front yards, because it was kind of getting nuts for me. You know, it's not nuts for some people, but for me it was. I just didn't want to be in that position. So that's when I happened to see a Willys wagon, and that started me into four-wheel drive, thinking that way. And we always went to Pismo Beach to ride our bikes, and another buddy shows up with this Jeep, flat fender. And all of a sudden, that's for sale, and I'm going, well, there's a flat fender Jeep right there instead of me building up this Willys. So I bought the flat fender, and it was a drag Jeep.
Okay.
And which... because we really wanted it for the sand. And I did the sand thing for a couple of years, and it was so fun. Oh, my God, it was so fun. And along there, I started meeting some of the guys, the Shooks and some of those people from Southern California that, you know, really knew how to drive. And they says, well, you don't have to just go straight up the dune and straight back down again. You can side hill a little bit, you know. And I go, oh, you can? So all of a sudden you start learning that. So we started having more fun. And now in the Jeep that I have now, well, so this is a drag Jeep. So, and it was pretty special already. It had 350 Chevy, turbo 400, independent rear, because it's a flat fender with a short wheelbase. And because of the long transmission, you only have an 8-inch drive shaft. So you can only have an independent rear suspension. So that was the beginning of my getting involved in that. It was a torsion bar suspension. So that was hung down. I bet your ground clearance was about 4 inches.
But in the sand, that's not so important.
Not in the sand.
Nope. The rocks are smaller.
Yeah. So along about this time, another buddy of mine, he just built up a Cherry Jeep that chrome everything. Of course, now I'm with the Southern California guys, right? And the cool thing in Southern California at that time was Cherry friggin' perfect Jeeps. Paint jobs, chrome, wheels, you know, the whole thing. I guess it might be the same as what we think today of an industry, because it was kind of the industry people I was kind of around.
Right.
At that point, I just happened to meld in with them, and I had a Jeep that could keep up with them. And, you know, you definitely knew how to find traction because you've been finding traction in motorcycles forever. And if you look at our off-road community now, I bet 80%, 90% of the fast guys have a motorcycle background.
Right.
Would you guess that?
I would guess the number's pretty high, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, you start understanding traction and what goes on. So anyhow, then he came up with this Jeep, and we basically put it together on a, as I remember, a Wednesday night, about six of us. And on Thursday morning, we left for the Jeepers Jamboree. And we had such a great time on the Jeepers Jamboree. We had four guys in this little Jeep. I don't think we even had sleeping bags because we didn't have a place to put them. And I remember we probably had two cases of beer, which is normal. And we had a great time. So I go, wow, that's so much fun. And I says, you know, our wives would love that too. So that's when I started thinking about, I need to take my Jeep and make it a dual sport so that I can run the dunes and also do the Rubicon. And so in 1980, I took that Jeep all the way down and then started building it back up with my own tube frame and rectangular tube frame and kind of the beginning of that. And then still trying to hold true to what everybody was doing with paint and all that kind of stuff. And I came up with, go ahead.
I would say your flat fender is one of the prettiest I've ever seen, if not the prettiest.
Well, thanks. it took a lot of thought. And I can tell you that you search out, I believe I went one more time on the Jeepers Jamboree and I did nothing but look at flat fenders and what they were doing. And you steal this idea from this guy and this idea from that guy. You know, there was no internet back then, so that's the only way you would start doing it was just watching people and what they were doing. And, you know, it could be an old junker Jeep, but, you know, they were doing something special. You just had to figure it out, so you started looking at stuff, and then you also saw the real pretty ones. And, you know, well, that's a neat idea. That's a pretty cool idea. So I just started messing with that, and about this time also I had changed jobs to another company in the packaging area. And I worked in a little small group that we helped customers improve their work or their business,
okay,
their packaging business. And we would build parts. And here again, you go back to mentors. And if you think about the ship's machinists,
right?
You know, the old Navy guys, that's what was in this group. There were two of these guys, and they could make machines sing and do things, you know, no digital readouts, no nothing. And I'd be in there doing my engineering and making drawings, and I'd make sure that I always walked out into the shop about every hour, try to keep up with these guys and see what they were doing, how they were doing things, how they were clamping things, da-da-da-da-da. That helped me also come back in and then build this Jeep to where things kind of came out the way they you thought they should.
Okay.
So I did the independent suspension. So that went on till maybe mid-90s. By this time, the tires were starting to get 35 inches.
Right.
And I was stuck on 33s. There was just no way I could put a 35 on there. And everybody started lifting their Jeeps so they could put on these big tires. And I go, wow, look at how easy they go over all this stuff with those 35s. I says, but now I can't have a dual sport. I can't lift my Jeep and then go down into the dunes. Because by this time, I had perfected side hilling to the fact where I can side hill. I can actually come down off of a dune, make a U-turn, and go back up right in the middle of the dune.
Wow.
And basically what you're doing is you're coming down, you're starting to cramp the wheel, and just about the time you're about ready to roll, you stand on the gas, and that brings the rear end around. You start going back up again.
You hope.
You hope. And in that process, you take in about 50 gallons of sand inside your Jeep because you're going right into the roost that's coming off the front wheel. So I always make sure that the passenger's on the downside.
There you go. Because
there's no way you can keep your eyes open and see where the hell you're going otherwise. But my claim to fame there is I can write my name on the side of pretty much any dune that's out there. You know, Ben, B-E-N. Just doing that cursive.
Wow. That's awesome.
It's kind of fun. So anyhow, lifting things was not the way to go. And so I started, okay, time to build a new Jeep. And then I started playing around with more aluminum. And so I built a couple aluminum independent suspensions for buddies using Corvette Model 44 center sections. And they came out great, so I go, oh, that's great. And then I said, well, got to have an aluminum front end, so I figured out a way to make a whole aluminum straight axle. And I was just about ready to start doing that and building the knuckles and the tubes and all that kind of stuff. And I actually had, out of Australia, a 9-inch center section built to where I could bolt on tubes for the front end to make a straight axle, an all-aluminum straight axle. And it was like twice as beefy as what the guys were using for drag racing, huh. Aluminum set. But I was all ready to go. And then that goddamn Campbell came along and tried his IFS. And that shot that down pretty quick because I started getting around. Wow, you can really go fast with independent front suspension. But I need to back up here also, because about this, a little bit in the mid-90s, I met this guy, Jeff Mello, through my brother. And we know Jeff for winning lots of rock competitions, things like that.
Yes.
And so I'd go up and help him because I, you know, what the hell is going on? What are these guys doing to be able to rock crawl like this? Jeff is an amazing person because I would go up there and he'd say, I got this problem. And we'd start talking about it. And I bet we'd come up to some kind of a, you know, I'm kind of a normally, okay, this is the way to go. And then you kind of think about it overnight or a week. And then you think about it to make sure you're not doing something different. Well, that's not Jeff. You come up with some kind of an idea, he brings out the Sawzall, and it's coming apart. It's getting done. And about 3 hours later, you're going to find out if it works or not. that was kind of a, you know, fun deal. And then he also got involved, you know, right at the, not the totally beginning, but right at the beginning of King of the Hammers.
Yes.
And, so here you're building the car for that. And, of course, he knew what to do. So I was just more or less a garage sweeper is what I call myself and helping out where I could. That was also Charlene, you know, has a history in the off-road. And she picked up on helping Dave Cole out those first years and putting that King of the Hammers together, and also the town.
Right.
I think she, I can remember her going to the Mountain View city manager and saying, how do I build a town? I have to build a town in the middle of the desert. Well, you got to have streets, you got to have sewers, you got to have water, you got to have, you know, da da da. Not sewers, but, you know, restrooms. Gave her the bullet points, and then she went from there. So, and Dave, of course, was in charge of the race, and, you know, they kind of split things up. It wasn't just her, there was a whole group.
Right.
But boy, how much did we learn? How much did we learn?
A lot, yep.
Those so the deal days. With the Campbell, yeah. So what happened also is there was no media at that time. And Charlene says, I got to have media. I got to promote this somehow. So I got looked into learning, you know, buying a camera, a video camera, and cameras, and things like that. And I started taking video of the racers. And because of the motorcycle stuff, you start seeing, you know, what works and what doesn't, and da-da-da goes on. And, boy, that guy screwed up. Now, was that because of the car, or was that because of the driver or the co-driver? Because the co-driver can be just as responsible for, let's say, winching.
Yep.
You know, they can destroy your car with a winch. So you start seeing all this stuff, and at that time I was riding motorcycles, so I could get to 10 different places and in a race and check with people and see all kinds of different stuff. And it was just darn interesting to me. And then all of a sudden once you start editing this stuff, you're looking at these videos 3 and 4 times, and you start just seeing more and more and more. Well, when Shannon started kept up with his IFS, I was still taking a lot of those videos, and for some reason I just focused in on the IFS because I'm kind of the techie guy, and I saw that was a way to, you know, he beat everybody. Just so what did you do? Beat everybody like an hour or something like that?
Yes.
It was crazy.
Yep.
Yeah, so started looking at that, and all of a sudden I'm going, oh, man, I already have 2 new flat fenders in my garage in parts on the shelf, and now you're going to throw it all away and think about independent front suspension. My 9-to-5 project is still going, and it's 2021. But I'm getting closer because I am building parts.
Excellent.
And my budget probably went up 200%.
We don't 2000%. Think about those things. You hide the credit card statements.
Deanna is unbelievable and forgiving. She says, hey, if you're on the garage, I know exactly where you're at. You know, and so we get along just fine.
Excellent.
And we enjoy the off-road. We enjoy the people, the camaraderie. You know, I can tell you that and this is another aside, being in sports and not pro sports, because it wasn't a big deal back then necessarily, but, you know, at a fairly high level of sports, I don't have any friends. I mean, friends that were friendly, if I ever see them.
Right.
But it's not a community. And I don't know if that's because when you're into teams, you're into sports like that, you're trying to be an individual in a sport, and you're trying to be the best, and you're forgetting about the team and the team spirit afterwards. You're not going out and drinking beer with them necessarily. You know, where now there's this camaraderie that, you know, everybody's pulling together and doing stuff. It's a totally different experience.
It's that collective.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And you can't knock the person who's in it to win at all cost, because I can remember doing that in sports. You know, I mean, you can't knock it. It's just different.
Right.
Where were we? We were just starting to...
You were talking about Mello and how you met Jeff, and then the IFS project that you started in on, and because of what Campbell had put together. So that leads us into your helping and working with Jason in that same garage at first?
Not the same garage. I did not know Jason.
Okay.
I did not know Jason. I don't even know if he came. I'm sure he probably, let's say this. I knew Jason, but not intimately.
Okay.
As it wound up being working at his garage. One day I get this call from him and he says, Ben, you're the only guy that knows independent suspension. And we're going to have a meeting of about 10 guys and we're going to talk about independent suspension. And I go, well, I don't know what to do, but I know what not to do, because I had messed with independent front suspension back when I got the car. And I found out I had an independent suspension, kind of messed with it, and it was easy because the car had independent suspension on it one time before. When you go over back then, you didn't use CVs, you used universal joints.
Right.
So if you went over a rock, you've used up a universal joint and you can't turn. Or if you turn, you can't go over a rock because now your wheel's going to straighten out because of the universal joint, you know. It was one of the two. You know, there just was not enough there to go both directions. And a lot of that didn't really happen until the guys figured that out, trying to remember who did Campbell's independent front suspension. But it had been worked out, you know, down there in L.A. So anyhow, it had been worked out. And so there was some, I started looking at it and I'm saying, oh, okay, I see what's going on here a little bit. So when Jason had his little get together, he says, well, I know what not to do. And so, you know, we all noted that stuff down. And I believe about that time, Tim Lund was starting to do a lot of work with the Toyota stuff. So he was a lot fresher on, you know, what was going on from the Toyota side of it.
Right.
And his son Dallas was starting to play around with, he was also, I believe, going to college and with some suspension information, you know, classes and things like that. And also started getting good at CAD, and really good at CAD, actually. And so we started talking, and they started developing, and I started seeing things in the videos as IFS became a little more popular, because I think by the next year, Shannon might have had couple other people that had independent front suspensions, but you could also see starting with the geometry and the tires tucking under and doing different stuff. You can't turn a motorcycle with a tire going tucked under the wrong direction. So right. Here again, it goes back. You want that tire sticking out there so it's, you know, pushing into the berm and doing its thing. And you started seeing the trophy trucks and all those type people, and they were doing it with the independent two-wheel drive stuff. So they knew what was going on. So I said, well, you know, you need to do this, or, you know, think about this, do that. And Dallas kept working at it. I mean, thousands of hours. Came out with the first one, and, you know, there's always issues. And then Jason did a second one and a third one and da-da-da. You know, the developments keep going on as you learn more and more about what makes the difference.
True.
And how much does an independent suspension make? If you look at the how many straight axles won the last couple of years, you wonder, you know, is an independent the solution?
You know,
I think
I think that it's truly the design of the race courses bring out the engineering qualities of both types of, you know, whether it's straight axle or, and even at straight axle, there's guys are doing it differently than each other. You know, yeah, the axle may be there, but it's the weight and the way that that live axle, straight axle is working with weight distribution and everything. And I think that there's a lot to be said for finding what works, but never knowing what exactly the course is going to be is one of the things that that plays into that, especially at KOH.
Yes, because you have more area to go for speed. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, well, you know, the course designer, Dave, or whoever it is that's actually designing the course, can throw in a lot of high-speed stuff for a long distance in an area where the straight axle cars may not be able to reach as high a speeds. But then if you throw in the rock trails in between that, it can slow that overall speed down, and where, you know, the straight axle cars have an advantage is in big rocks and big holes, you know, and whether it's going uphill or downhill, you know, you can watch at least what I've noticed, and, you know, I'm not an engineering person by any means, and definitely not a fabricator. I couldn't weld anything together to make it last. I'm a grinder, is what you might say, a filler, you know, and
me too.
But what I see with an independent cars is guys have had to make them that bulkhead in front of the diff very strong so that they could plow through the rocks, where a straight axle car can be more nimble in the rocks, but not at high speeds.
Okay.
That's how
I have a little different take on that.
Okay. That's good.
Okay. What I'm seeing now, I have not driven an independent car.
Right.
I have not driven the straight axle car to that. If you think about, you know, to that, you know, King of the Hammers, the good cars, let's
yes.
put it that way. But what I'm seeing, the independent car, of course, has the advantage of being independent, in which only one wheel is being disrupted normally. But the problem with the independent car versus straight axles, the independent car is very rarely going to be able to turn better than about 37, 38 degrees.
Right.
Where your straight axle is easily 45 and maybe more in today's world.
Yes.
It definitely wasn't that way 10 years ago when King of the Hammer started, but it is today. And so, yes, the straight axle has that turning ability. I call an independent car a missile because it is made to go straight and it's made to use the skids.
Yes.
And that's how the guys drive them.
Yes.
And hopefully when they're becoming a missile, they don't take their rock straight onto a wheel.
Yes.
You know, and break something really, really, really crazy. But from a winching standpoint, an independent car will outwinch a straight axle every day of the month because there's no front diff to catch on anything.
Okay.
You'll winch twice as fast in an independent car if you ever get down to that area because they're built to skid, where you have that front differential there and it's nothing but a hindrance to the poor driver. Now, can you winch sideways? Not. Well, probably both cars is not going to take that, you know, to winch something sideways and put so much force on an upright or see, you know, where you break something.
Right. I think we saw that probably this year in Cody Wagner's car. There.
In spades. In spades.
Yes.
Yep. I never said it. I'm glad you did. Well, at least we know it's been talked about, right?
Yes. Yeah, I'm sure that they've looked at the video of their attempts to get around that rock, and I'm sure Wayne has looked at it and said, oh my Lord, I should have done this or that instead of what they did. But you know, in a race situation, you're, you know, it's almost panic at that point when you're not progressing and things just seem like they're getting worse and worse. You know, you're trying everything instead of really thinking about what has to happen. And I think that that's, you know, that's completely understandable, but I think that they're going to, everybody that watches that part of the live coverage, or watched that part of the film will see that there was maybe options. I mean, at least from the viewer standpoint, maybe there wasn't in that hole.
Yeah, I agree with that because I never said anything because we don't know where a winching point might have been.
Right. I'll have to have that conversation with Wayne. Interesting.
Yeah. That was the first time I seen it.
Right.
I probably have, oh God, I just happened to find a 2015 where everybody was winching going up one of those canyons, everybody, and I probably got 2 hours of winching.
Oh, that was probably Jackhammer, where everything, where they just had the long line. Yes.
Yeah, it was nuts, and you just see the independent cars just, you know, go right through, and the other guys just getting hung up, frustrated, and even then, you know, the guy that they were trying to, the point that they were trying to winch to was not in the best place.
True.
To get him through the rocks, you know. So anyhow, it was wasn't the first time I've been to places, you know, where they've had to winch, and just, you saw that.
Yes.
An independent car will outwinch a straight axle car. Just, there's no question about it. But you got to be smart about it. How's that?
Right. There you go.
The things have happened with straight axle in the last few years with steering that have made them competitive again. Now, guys couldn't go fast at the beginning of Can of the Hammers because they had so much rear steer in the four bar systems. And once they got that straightened out, where there's no rear steer, you know, from articulation,
yep.
The you know, the speeds went from the 60s to the 80s to the 90s, and then independent from the 90s on up, probably independent fronts has probably got them from the 90s to the 110s and greater. But what's happened with the straight axle is the guys have gotten new technology now to where the straight axles have almost a mechanical linkage to them, to the hydraulics. And a lot of that was discussed out on Pirate, you know, back and forth and worked out. And, you know, the Millers clamped onto that and through
Radial Dynamics.
Pardon?
Is it Radial Dynamics?
Yes.
Right.
And, you know, he came up with, you know, some good reservoirs and really made a good science out of it, you know, and along with a couple other guys. And, man, they have those front ends dialed so that they're not hunting and doing all this stuff and they can they have confidence to get above 100 miles an hour and not feel like, you know, they're
like they're trying to walk on over ice the handlebars. Run on ice. Exactly.
So I think that's why a lot of the straight axles are coming back, you know, to play with the independent cars, was because of the steering technology. True. And if I had to build a car today, without the independent suspension, I'd build a straight axle car. I wouldn't put $20,000 into parts. I mean, shit, just the steering alone, $7,000.
Right.
You know, for an independent car, just the parts. I'd build a straight axle car because I think you'd go just as.
Especially for that race, for KOH.
Well, and even for the recreational person.
Right. No, I agree.
For sure, but for the recreational.
About the other races in the Ultra 4 Series, I think that some of those more desert-type races where the rock crawling isn't as prevalent and it's not, you know, or extreme, that the... And especially in a short more of a short course environment, the IFS cars are way, way more capable than the straight axle cars.
Well, let's look at this. Every independent suspension car out there has a $40,000 motor in it.
True.
How many straight axle cars are out there with $40,000 motors?
Yep.
You know, I don't know where to go with that, but I understand it. I understand where you're coming from, especially, you know, Reno. But here again, what we learned in independent suspension was camber. And you want to have those tires never, ever seeing positive camber. And that was one of the things that, I don't think I'm saying anything out of school because it's kind of old news at this point. Whether you're turning your wheels, whatever, you never want to have that tire go into positive camber. In other words, the top pointing out. You always want to have the top in and the tires digging in, because I've seen tires, here again, you can go back to, I can almost at one point tell the difference in tires just by the way they reacted and how far they tucked under a wheel. I've seen a lot of tires tuck halfway into the center of the wheel, the outside of the tire go into the center of the wheel. And I'm kind of going, holy crap. So we talked about Jason and being part of his group, and there's a lot of discussion that goes on. And there's things that I see that I can't tell. I don't expect Jason to take any of our comments. Anybody on the crew can make a comment. And if anybody has a question in that crew, it makes sure that the answer is there. Right. That we understand the answer, what went on and why it was done that way, so that you understood it completely. And then you could, you know, go on from that. But Jason has an incredible mind to search things out. So if he senses something that's credible, I'm sure he'll air it out with all kinds of different people. I mean, there's a reason that there's probably on number three or number four build or design change, you know.
Yep.
And who knows what's going to happen now with portals. Who knows what's going to happen with those.
Exactly.
I'm sure we're going to see portals out there, but you know what that does to suspension. I can't get my head around it, but I know that it does different things to links, to, you know, to A-arms, to squat, everything else. So
yeah, the force dynamics are a lot different than what everybody's used to using. Going slow with portals is a completely different beast than trying to go fast. But you know, there's some great minds out there working on these things.
Well, and this is, I think what happened, what's really neat is the Trophy Truck guys finally grabbed a hold of it.
Yes.
They have the engineering power and resources and money.
Yep.
To get out, you know, and Mason's on top of it, and everything I look at and see, and I'm not seeing anything negative.
Interesting.
You know, or I can look at some of our stuff and kind of go, ooh, okay, or I don't understand it. I know Joe Thompson, you know, builds cars with a completely different design theory to it. But I see his cars out there, and I say, God damn, those tires are doing what they should be doing.
Yep.
and, you know, he's a smart dude. But he's a unique person. He's not, I don't want to say educated, he's experienced. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
From an education standpoint, but the experience that's there and playing around with what he's playing with, just doing an incredible job. Where all of a sudden you get down into the Mason group and the Geysers and those type people, and all of a sudden you got two or three different CAD people, and everybody's, you know, off beating off of each other, and they have all this two-wheel drive experience with front ends. You know, where we really didn't have the experience of two-wheel drive and trying to make a front end pull around a corner.
Right.
Everybody can go fast straight. That's just a matter of how tight your pants are.
Exactly. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. But if you're, you know, going around corners, that's a whole different item. You still have to be able to read trail, you know.
So
drop off.
Yeah. Stuff. So are you predicting that the newest technology is going to be in the portals with rock sports? I know it is in the rock crawling, but in the rock racing?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
But I don't know that it's going to be, let's put it this way. I think a number of people have driven Cody's car that's portals,
right,
independent portals. And they like the ride. I think the ride is too soft, and I think the guys that are driving it thought it was too soft, which made it a comfortable ride. And they didn't hit as many rocks. And if you think about a King of the Hammers, where a guy's doing 6-8 hours and hitting these rocks hard, being a missile, to be able to only miss half the rocks
yeah,
that hard. And, you know, you talked about the front ends being built so tough. They have to be tough because that's the way they're driven.
Yes. You have to keep one of the things that I've noticed with independent is the momentum factor. You know, you can crawl, stop, continue with a straight axle car, you know, reposition that diff, try to get that tire, you know, where you need it, where with the independent, it just seems like, okay, let's just shove this through. Because I don't have that steering. I don't have I'm not as nimble because of the steering that, you know, yeah, I can slide over things. So I'm going to use that momentum to do that. That's what I meant.
Well, that's part of it. But also, you know, when you're at full compression,
right,
your frame is only about 2 inches off the ground.
Yeah.
So that front skid, if it's straight up and down, there's been a couple guys that got flown out on helicopters. You know who they are.
Yes.
Because their front skid was too straight up and down. And when they hit that rock, it just stopped them immediately. And if you got a front skid that's, it has to be a minimum of 45 degrees. And if you can get it any other, you know, so it glances off stuff. I know it sticks out, looks like hell, but whatever.
Yep.
You know, that's what makes that thing work. Independent rear, I have independent rear. I would never build another car independent rear because I have 24 inches of, I could have 24 inches of rear suspension, no problem at all in my independent rear because I built a real narrow center section and everything was made for it. But in reality, I've only got 18 inches because at full compression, I'm 4 inches under the ground.
True. Okay.
Know what I'm, see where I'm going with that?
Yes.
And so the same holds true for the front. So you're going to see the guys trying to glance off stuff. They're trying to accelerate to get that front end to lift, you know, instead of go into compression.
Yes.
It's a way different, it's just a way different dynamic.
Right. And driving, and definitely a different driving style.
Yeah. And you add four, you add another 4 inches of clearance to that front end. Yeah.
Yep.
I think portals in the front is going to make a big difference, especially for, just especially for the driver. It's going to allow them to crash into stuff harder.
Yep. Well, cool.
Still going to still run a straight axle in the rear just because I know that because of the, you know, the front end going down and digging the dirt.
Right.
Compression.
So anything else that we haven't talked about that you want to hit?
Not necessarily. God, I think we've kind of cruised along. Unless you can think of something. I know you were talking about Charlene. All we're just 100% supportive,
excellent,
you know, helping that along. She's done everything by herself, basically. She found her little, found her niches along the way, found jobs.
Yep.
I found her first job in a motorcycle shop. On the first day, she comes back home and I say, so how was your first day on the job, Charlene? She says, Dad, I changed so many effing tires today, you won't believe it. And that shop had to do it. If you sold a tire, you had to change it.
Wow.
You had to pound it.
So you had to get fast at it so that you could make more money. So you could sell more tires. Yep.
Yeah. But we had a good time on motorcycles. You know, it's in our family, the whole family. We do long motorcycle rides. We'd unload in Reno and ride to the Oregon border and back in a weekend, 500 miles and basically trails, and that's how Barbara and Rainey and us kind of understand the northern and southern Nevada trails and all the back roads, because I had a lot of guys that lived up there, and we'd go out and we'd put on 500 miles in a weekend and on bikes.
That's awesome.
And the only thing that would stop us was trying to find fuel, and I can tell you, we know every rancher in northern and southern Nevada trying to bum gas.
Siphon gas out of their trucks or whatever you could.
Yeah, well, a lot of it was before GPS. You're going the wrong direction. You go 10 miles the wrong direction and you come back. That's 20 miles out of your 120-mile tank of gas, you know?
So. That's awesome.
At that point, oh, God, there's so many stories. The long, long hauls, but I've been very lucky. I think we were very lucky in the 70s to be able to ride places that are all closed today.
True.
There's very few, you know, back roads or back places in California are probably done. Now all hiking trails,
yep,
you know. So.
And if some got their way, that would happen to all the trails.
Yeah.
And hopefully I guess that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we're lucky. I consider myself lucky to have been at the right place at the right time. In the 60s, the bikes weren't all that reliable, so you couldn't get 25 miles from your truck. You know, you started into the 70s, and the bikes started getting more reliable, and you could do 70 miles. We'd go out and stash gas, you know, out in the middle of the desert, number of different places, so we could keep riding. So you know, a lot of history of the, in that portion of off-roading. Been pretty lucky. Yes. Seeing stuff.
Well, that's awesome. Ben, we're approaching an
long
hour
time.
And 45 minutes. I want to say
sorry no. Everybody.
Oh no, don't worry about it. We've done very good, and it'll be a great interview that everybody gets to listen to. Trust me.
Well, I hope that everybody appreciates the people that they're around and listen, you know, and talk about issues and problems. And, I mean, you can't do it alone. There's other people that, you know, everybody pitches in. You know, there's one little comment that someone can make a big difference in modifications you make to your Jeep or do whatever.
Right.
And yes, we watch the industry people too. You know, they're helping us. They're helping us so I don't have to make it.
There you
Gen
go.
Wright, Tony at Gen Wright makes me mad. He says, I can't buy a new Jeep. And he says, why can't you buy a new Jeep? I says, because you make everything. I wouldn't have fun.
Couldn't make it all yourself. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great place to end it. So, Ben, thank you so much for coming on Conversations with Big Rich and spending some time talking about your life and what you've done in off-road and who you know and the things that have interested you, because I know that's going to be of an interest to our listeners. I know I was captivated, so I want to say thank you so much.
Well, thanks for giving me a call.
Yeah, no worries. And hopefully
we'll see you on the trail for sure. Yeah,
hopefully we get to see you soon. Thank you, Ben.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you enjoy these podcasts, please give us a rating. Share some feedback with us via Facebook or Instagram, and share our link among your friends who might be like-minded. Well, that brings this episode to an end. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll catch you next week with Conversations with Big Rich. Thank you very much.